after consultation with Giffrey. This talk will have a lot of overlap with the seminar I gave here in February of this year. So if you have visited this, then you will recognize a lot of things, but I heard this should be okay. And what I want to do today is I want to show you where we stand in solving lattice QCD, but I also want to point out what are our challenges and how we address this with essentially matrix product states. And I also want to give you a glimpse about quantum computing, which would be the real goal and aim to solve QCD eventually. So to bring us on the same page, I want to remind maybe the older people or the senior people how we know that there are quarks, and maybe the younger people how we know that there are quarks. And this we know since about 1972, where there was a very famous experiment by Friedman and Kendall. So they made a scattering experiment. They took some electrons and shot it to the proton. And what they saw is that the cross-section of the scattering experiment was completely independent from the energy they probed the proton with. And the only interpretation that you could give at that time then was, well, the proton must exist basically as nothing, but if you do the normalization correctly, there should be just three constituents. And this was a very famous experiment which inspired Feynman and also Bjorkain to interpret this experiment here really as a parton model, saying that the proton consists essentially out of three partons. And this was really the first moment in history that people started to believe that there are partons or quarks. So this was really a breakthrough and a real change of the game. Then later on, these experiments became much more complicated, much more detailed. And if you now do the normalization correctly, so you express the cross-section through these structure functions, then you find a leading three, which exactly corresponds to three point-like partons. And then you get corrections, and these corrections come with the strong coupling constant, which depend on Q square, which is the energy by which you probe the proton. And then instead of having the delta function, which correspond to the partons here, what you get is a smeared out function. And this shows the indication that there is an interaction between the quarks, that there are gluons, and that there are spontaneous generations of quarks and antiquarks, and that this gets smeared out. And these deviations from three here, and this dependence on the strong coupling constant, which you can give to a pretty high order, actually serves as a mean to determine the scale dependence of the strong coupling constant. And this you do by very detailed experiments, for example here, which this was done at DESY in Hamburg, where I'm coming from originally. And you see that these structure functions that enter the cross-section here, they can be determined very precisely. And from the functional form of this structure function, you can determine, for example, the strong coupling constant. So that's a standard way in experimental physics, combining with this theoretical expectation to get information on the basic constituents of QCD. And you not only get the coupling here, but also the quark mass if you analyze these precise structure functions in the correct way. Now, this is very nice, but the picture doesn't stop there. It becomes, please, Ray.
So this was still scattering of electrons to the nucleus?
This at DESY, this was electron-proton scattering. Huh? This was the Hera ring. And these are the famous experiments, H1 and Zeus, were also, by the way, the gluon was discovered. There was, in these experiments, you could also see that there must be a gluon. And this was really the big thing at DESY. But it was electron-proton scattering in this case.
Do you mind taking the hockey stick instead of the pointer?
I don't mind.
First we're in Canada.
I don't mind at all, because you like this more, or you can point it.
Yeah, it is easier. I find it hard to follow.
It's too small, right?
Too small.
But I still need to... I would like to...
Okay, you lost your mic.
This is only because I had to do this. But you can read the page already. That I can talk at the same time. So the situation becomes really incredibly complicated. There are a lot of generations of quarks and antiquarks and gluons. And it's not only that it becomes very, very complicated to compute all these processes at the same time, but there's also a conceptual problem. And the conceptual problem is, I told you that the coupling constant depends on the scale where you probe the proton. And this you can translate in natural unit, that it depends on the distance that you probe the proton. And it turns out if you go to a distance of about 1 Fermi, which is roughly the diameter of a proton, then this coupling constant becomes at the order of 1. So there's no way whatsoever to analyze this situation in perturbation theory, not even in principle. It's not possible to calculate all possible Feynman diagrams. You need more. You need a method that really gets the non-perturbative nature of the proton. And this was Wilson's starting point to say, we need something else, and therefore he invented this lattice QCD. And this was really necessary because our world in QCD, the strong interaction, really has a Janus hat character. At very small distances, if you go much below 1 Fermi, then you really enter the world of quarks and gluons, and you will find the perturbative description of the situation. And this is something that we call asymptotic freedom, which means that essentially you have a perturbative, almost free interaction between quarks and gluons. If, on the other hand, you go to distances that are about or larger than 1 Fermi, you enter the world that we actually see in experiment, namely you enter the world of hadrons, of protons, pions, and also of glue balls. And for this, you clearly need non-perturbative methods, because in these hadrons, the quarks are confined. And QCD is a theory that actually should describe for you both sides of this Janus head, and it claims that there is a smooth transition between a region where you have asymptotic freedom and confinement, and for example, no phase transition, which would completely separate these two worlds. This does not happen. And in order to cover this site here, I'm still phrasing Wilson, who said in his Gage's lecture notes that unfortunately, it is not known yet whether the quarks in quantum QCD actually form the required bound states. And to establish whether these bound states exist, one must solve a strong coupling problem, this confinement, and present methods for solving field theories don't work for strong coupling. Okay. So, what is this lattice QCD? How does it work then? And I don't want to give you QCD because there is technically rather complicated. So let's go to a simpler model with this, which is the Schwinger model invented by Schwinger in 62 to explain mass generation, actually. This is typically something I do with summer students at DESY in Zeuthen. So this is an 8-week program. And in the end, they can really program this model on a lattice and do simulations. So this should do it also for us here. So the starting point is Feynman's path integral. So we have an integral over all possible gauge fields and the quark fields or the fermion fields, and we weight them in Euclidean time with an action of the gauge fields and action of the fermions. The action of the fermions look in a standard way, so it's two-dimensional, Euclidean time, so it's the same. And then you have a Dirac operator in which you have the quark mass or the fermion mass, and you have the gauge covariant derivative that you know. And for the gauge action, you have simply the standard F mu nu term. And if you do this on the classical level with this action, you can derive the two-dimensional classical Maxwell equations. This is completely standard, and the quantization goes via integrating over all possible field configurations. So this is the model we want to study in the continuum. This is a benchmark model, but it has already very interesting properties. It has the confinement of charges. It has bound states. You can find bound states there. It has chiral symmetry breaking. It's very nice. You don't have to renormalize it. And it is really a benchmark. You can solve it exactly in the massless case. So this is really a great benchmark model which has important physical phenomena and give you really analytical results to test. So, What we want to do is, we want to put this theory on a lattice. So what we do, we take our continuum points and discretize them. So t and x become integer, and you have a two-dimensional lattice here with lattice points, and you put your quark fields exactly on this lattice point. So you have the quark field and the anti-quark field, and you put this on these integer numbers. And then you get the discretized form of the fermion action. So this integral becomes a sum multiplied by the lattice spacing A. And then the Dirac operator, we have no gauge fields at the moment, looks like this. So you have a d slash a gamma mu d mu. And then you have the quark mass. And what you do here, you do the most simple thing you can imagine. So this mu is just a combination of a forward and backward derivative. And this derivative is nothing else but the nearest neighbor difference of the fermion field. So you take a field at the point x, shift it by one lattice spacing in a certain direction, subtract the field at x, divide by a, and you can see if you take the continuum limit of this expression, you get back the continuum derivative. And the same for the backward derivative here. So this is really the most naive thing you can think of if you want to discretize the system on a lattice. You need to introduce an additional term, which I will not discuss, and this is simply there to remove some unwanted modes that you get in this lattice description. Somebody's interested, I can explain this. So this part is nice. I really ask you to follow Ray's example. If you have any question during the talk, just raise your hand, even if you want that I change the stick back to my... Okay. So what I really found ingenious with Wilson's proposal was that he actually realized that it's not the gauge potential itself which is the basic element of a field theory, but that it is the parallel transporter, e to the e I lattice spacing times this gauge potential. So this tells you if I have a charge at a point x, how do I transport this charge locally through this parallel transporter here to a neighboring point, or if you want, also through the lattice. And using this parallel transporter, the so-called link variable, the lattice derivative of the fermions can be made gauge invariant by multiplying now this field at the neighboring point, x plus mu, with this parallel transporter and subtract this psi of x. And what you can show if you take the limit a to zero of this expression, you will recover the continuum gauge covariant derivative that we had before. Now, if you want to set up the action for the gauge field, you use again this parallel transporter. You want to have something gauge invariant. And this leads to the fact that you have to consider products of these parallel transporters around such a plaquette. So this goes here, then you go up, which is this part, and then you go in this direction. This is why we need the dagger here. And then you go down again. This is also why we need the dagger here. And what you can show that this so-called plaquette variable goes indeed to the field strength tensor in the naive continuum limit. And this gives us a fully gauge invariant formulation of a field theory on a lattice. And we want to keep gauge invariance because this is deeply connected to the renormalizability of the theory, and this we want to keep. And therefore, the total action in the end looks like this. So we have an integral which becomes a sum, then we have a parameter beta which is 1 over the bare coupling, then we have this plaquette variable, and we have this gauge covariant action for the fermions. And in order now to quantize this theory, what we do is we introduce the path integral, or in statistical physics, the partition function, and with the Boltzmann weight, or the action S, and then the partition function looks like this. And then we have a fully discretized gauge invariant lattice gauge theory for the Schwinger model. And then we want to go on, and we want to measure some observable, like the proton mass, and what we do there, we put this into the integral, integrate over all possible field configurations and normalize it by the partition function. We use this lattice discretization, and then we put it into a program, and then we put it on a supercomputer. So all the people who visited my seminar in February are not allowed to raise their hand, but the others, I'm asking, does anybody know what a supercomputer is? That's really amazing. There was only one occasion where I got an answer where almost everybody raised a hand. And this was at the Leibniz Supercomputer Center in Germany. And the reason is that this is the Leibniz machine from 1670. So you could turn this wheel and you could do additions and multiplications with the machine. There are replicas of this in museums, and this really works. And this was for the very first time a machine where you could do additions and multiplications. So really an amazing thing. Okay, so of course we do not want to stay with the Schwinger model. We want to go to QCD. What does this mean? Our system, let's say we have a 50 by 50 lattice size, goes to 50 by 50 times 2,500. So we go to four dimensions. Our gauge fields were out of U1. For QCD, we have to go to SU3. And then the quarks receive four Dirac components and three color components from the SU3, which means we go from 50 times 50 to 50 times 50 times 30,000. And if you now imagine that if I do a typical simulation of the Schwinger model on such a lattice, this takes several days, then I have to multiply this with 30,000 to go to QCD, which means that I need massive parallelization to solve the theory. And it needs now really non-perturbative randomization too. So you really go from this stock to this stock, and this is much more complicated. So, and this is really something, this property of QCD was something that led actually Wilson to quit the field, because we had a conference in Berlin in 2001, and we asked collaborations around the world, what is actually the cost of your simulation? And this plot shows the number of teraflop years that you need to compute, for example, the proton mass at only one set of parameters, okay? So teraflops, your laptops here may have one gigaflop. So this is a factor a million. So if you have a million of your laptops and you let it run for this number of years, then you might get a result. And this is plotted as a function of the pseudoscalar mass over the vector mass. And in nature, this corresponds to the pion mass, to the rho mass. So you want to go here. This is what we call the physical point. So this is the point where this ratio assumes really is its physical value. And this is now for certain values of the lattice spacing, very coarse and a little bit finer. And what you see is the cost to simulate these theories grows exponentially. This is actually the law that was found at the time. It grows very, very fast, and you can extrapolate this. And you see this is completely impossible. So this had two effects. The first effect was Wilson quitted the field because he said this is impossible. Because if you would calculate this at the time, like 1990, he said we need a 10 to the 8 increase in computing power to make any contact to experiment, which meant in this time the need of exaflop computers, which was completely out of sight. And the second effect was, this is again more to the senior people, this plot was forbidden to show in public. Because we would not have gotten any sense for continuing our work. But we have been stubborn. And there was really, at the same time, there were a number of groups who found algorithmic improvements that really changed completely the picture. So this is the graph that I just showed you in 2001. This is the same graph with this improved algorithms. Again, the number of teraflop years as a function of the ratio of the pion to the rho mass, so you want to go here. And what you see, yes, you get still this exponential increase or this very large increase of the cost, but now the scale here changed by a factor of 100, which means that now, if you have teraflops and now we have petaflop machines, such a calculation becomes really feasible within a year's time. And this completely changed the picture of lattice QCD calculation. And nowadays, we can do simulations here.
Can you tell us more about what improvements happen?
I think this we better do privately. This would be almost, there are several improvements. There is some preconditioning techniques. You have to precondition the matrix, which is tricky by itself. Then we can discuss it privately. Okay, at the same time, we didn't stay really with the Leibniz computer, but there was some development. And in Germany, for example, we have three supercomputer centers, one in Jülich, and where we have like 12 petaflops on this machine. Then in Berlin and Hannover, we have this Leibniz supercomputer center in Munich too. So all in all, we come in Germany at the moment between 20 and 30 petaflops, which is a factor of 1,000 more than teraflops. And here in the States, we have nowadays machines that can reach 200 petaflops already. So we are very close to the exaflop area that everybody wanted. And all these developments brought us then to this picture here, where I show, this is by this collaboration, this is BMW, this is not a German car company, as everybody knows, but this is this stands for Budapest, Marseille, Wuppertal. And what this is here is for the very first time a calculation of the complete low-lying baryon spectrum from lattice QCD. The only input is you have to fix the up and down quark mass, and you have to fix the strange quark mass. So you you match the pion and the kaon, and all the rest is a prediction from lattice QCD. And this is compared to the experimental values. And what you can see that from this ab initio lattice calculation, we can really reproduce the complete low-lying baryon spectrum within the arrows. And this is really in the continuum limit and at the physical value of the pion mass, as you can see here, it's matched here. And this is really a prediction now from lattice QCD, and all other quantities that you compute in lattice QCD, fixing only these two masses here, would be a prediction of QCD. We repeated this a little bit later also for even heavier baryon masses. We also found agreement. So this is really the first time in history that this could be achieved. And at this point in my talk, I usually say that when I gave talks before this plot and these works, there was always one person in the audience who told me, as long as you don't prove to me that you can compute the low-lying baryon spectrum, I don't believe you a word. Here it is. Trust me. Okay, and we can even go further. And this I really find completely amazing. You know, the quarks have charge. The values of the quark mass and the up quark mass and the down quark mass are different. This is an effect of isospin breaking. And this has a very important effect. This has the effect that the neutron is larger than the proton. And this is why we exist here. Else the proton would decay, and with the proton, we would decay. And this effect is really on the MeV level, whereas the mass of the proton is at the GeV level. So we are talking about effects below a percent. And what this group has done here, it has computed these effects. Now always comes this point, I'm colorblind, so I do not know which is now QED and which is isospin breaking. But what you can see, the effect now computed from lattice QCD, this is this bar here, they come in opposite direction. So the isospin breaking effect goes in the opposite direction in the mass difference than the QED, the charge effect. And if you sum this up, you get this here, and this is the mass difference between the neutron and the proton. So we are in lattice QCD at a precision at the moment where we can detect such mass differences, and we can take these effects into account also for many other quantities. And this just, I wanted to demonstrate to you where we stand in lattice QCD, that we really can now do really precision calculations using our improved algorithms and the existing supercomputers. And we have a lot of impact now in worldwide experiments. Hooray.
So these are results, very, very recent results, or 10 years?
This is already, I think, 4 years old. So we are getting even more precise at the moment. Adam?
Could you show the Berlin Wall again?
The what?
The Berlin Wall plot, the scaling plot.
For?
The time scaling plot.
The Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall. You want to have the Berlin Wall. Yeah. This one.
Yeah, so where, okay. Where on the plot would 2001 have been?
These are two curves of 2000. So here's the scaling law. We know
Right. Exactly
how it scales with this ratio of the pion mass to the rho mass, with the lattice size and with the lattice spacing.
So So, but like, where would, what would have been, like, I see that's the scaling, but what would actually be achievable at that time, like on the plot?
Ah, okay. At that time, we were maybe about here.
Right.
So we were wondering whether we can make contact to Kyle perturbation theory here.
So that which, like maybe a five-fold algorithmic speed-up would have gotten you where you want to be. Is that not right?
Say it again.
Well, if you shifted the constant factor and the exponential by a factor of 5 or 10,
yeah,
then you would be physical. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's not that bad. Like,
no, it's a factor of 100 here, right?
Factor of 100.
Oh. You see the scale. So this goes up to 20 teraflop years. Here we have 2.2 teraflop years.
You could shift the curve to the left in the way that you showed.
We could shift the wall. We could not break it. Nowadays we have algorithms that really break the wall.
Now you don't even have the scaling anymore. That's actually better.
Now the scaling with our algorithm is basically flat.
Okay.
So these are recent developments with multi-grid. So we don't stop with this. We really made further improvements there.
Fair enough.
Okay, coming back to this. So we are superheroes, right? I skipped this. But there are also very dangerous animals on the lattice. This is the famous alligator from the Florida conference. And these dangerous animals come from the fact that what I told you, what we had a Euclidean path integral. Euclidean path integral means that I have a positive Boltzmann factor here, and I can interpret this measure here that I have here as a positive probability density. If I have a positive probability density, I can apply all the methods that I know from statistical mechanics, Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, and they work absolutely perfectly as I demonstrated with the example of the baryon spectrum. However, if I have problems where, for example, I add a chemical potential or where I have a topological term like this here, then this integrand becomes complex. When this happens, I have huge fluctuations here in the integrand and not a peaked integrand as in this case here. And what this means in turn is if I look at an error of a certain observable and I look at the number of sample points, then not only the error stays constant instead of going down with 1 over square root of n, but also the error of the error is very, very large, can reach factors of 10 to 100. This means if I have such situations, then I cannot get any significant result from a lattice QCD calculation. Now, we could say, I don't care, but there are very important problems in nature that would introduce such terms. And the first example is the understanding of the early universe. So here is the temperature scale. Here is the net baryon density. What we do in lattice QCD, we only explore this axis here, so the temperature dependence. But if we go inside this diagram here, which means that we have to introduce a chemical potential, we cannot do lattice QCD calculations. So this means that this whole area here is completely unexplored. And this is relevant because we believe that somewhere here at such a density, we have the early universe. Here we have these collision experiments at RIC or at FAIR in the future. And really to understand how we come from a deconfined, from a confined phase to a deconfined phase, we cannot tell. Also, there are exotic things like these Kala superconductors or neutron stars. And at the moment, we cannot explore this with lattice QCD calculation. So basically, from this whole phase diagram of QCD at known zero temperature and known zero chemical potential, we only can explore a very, very small corner. And the rest is not there. The other example is really collisions. So there are certain, I will not go into this, but if you have collisions, there are a lot of phases and suggested phenomena like parton cascades, thermalization, and so on and so on. But in order to understand these collisions really in a fully known perturbative way, we would need real-time simulations. Real-time simulations mean we would have to be in Minkowski space. Minkowski space we cannot reach with lattice QCD because we live in Euclidean space, which means lattice QCD calculations cannot really explore real-time simulations. We have to find something else. Other question is CP violation. If you have a CP symmetry, this induces a difference between particles and antiparticles. And this is a necessary condition to understand the difference between matter and antimatter in the universe. So this leads to our sheer existence. And there is this funny effect that you can compute the amount of CP violation in the electroweak sector, and you get a number that is this. So this asymmetry is at the order of 10 to the minus 24. What you get from the electroweak sector is more like order 10 to the minus 11. So there is a small factor in the observed CP violation that we don't understand at all. And one interesting possibility is that actually there could be also CP violation in the strong sector in QCD. And in order to study this, you need to introduce a CP violation term. And this is this famous topological term with the vacuum angle theta. And if this vacuum angle theta would be large enough, this could give a large amount of CP violation in QCD itself, which might help to understand this huge discrepancy between observation and calculation. Please.
How could it help to understand that? Because
the angle is very
high temperature is very suppressed, because the physical effect will be proportional to the product of all quark masses divided by temperatures.
I know that this angle is very small, but you want
Not the angle. Angle, let's say
angle. The angle. So you are fine with the angle.
Even an angle order one, you need this. You appeal to this baryonic asymmetry, right? Which requires high temperature, right? The high temperature, you'd have. Mu over temperature times MD over temperature times MS over temperature. When you multiply it through, it's still a tiny number.
You can still, but what we like to do is we want to investigate this really non-perturbatively, right?
I totally sympathize that. I buy the argument that it's going to bridge that.
No. This was not meant as an argument. This is why I said help, giving a small amount. Okay, but my point is, because of the presence of this term here, again, Markov chain Monte Carlo is unable to answer such a question. Now, there is a solution. There is a clear solution, and actually, lattice QCD started with this solution. And this solution is to don't go to the action formulation, but take the Hamiltonian. And people who worked, like Wilson himself, Kogut, Lescher, in the very beginning of lattice field theory, they started with the Hamiltonian as an analytical tool to study such models. And then this was tried in practice. Can we use the Hamiltonian to shed light on these problems? And then it was very fast realized, if you have the Hamiltonian and you want to have the corresponding wave function, then you have to solve for this coefficient matrix with 2 to the n entries if you have a spin system plus minus 1. And even Berlin, this is the Berlin Tower, this is the Brandenburg Gate, would be covered with rice very fast. So this was then really stopped. There was no practical solution to the sign problem. And at the same time, Michael Kreutz performed the first Markov chain Monte Carlo simulations for SU2 and SU3 gauge theories in the 80s. And he immediately found that he can probe the system very efficiently. And then everything switched to action formulation and Markov chain Monte Carlo. But then at some point, I learned that maybe the relevant part of the Hilbert space is not so large as we think. And actually, you can show that when you have only a local density operator of this form here, and you approximate this local density operator with precision delta, then you get the exact ground state of the system by this formula here, which essentially means that you only have to scale your problem polynomially and not exponential. And what this shows is there must be a corner of the Hilbert space which is really important for catching the physics of the system. And you can also do this with the entropy arguments, which I skip. And then there was a particular ansatz followed by people, Stephen White, Hastings, Chirac, and also here, Parameter, Giffey, and this group are really doing a lot of calculations there, who said, what we can do is we make this matrix product state ansatz. So instead of looking at this huge tensor that I showed you before, I simply look at the trace of matrices, of product of matrices, which have entries, complex entries, And the matrices are of size d times d. And this d we call the bond dimension. These i's here are still the physical indices. So this means instead of having a problem with 2 to the n entries, we simply have a product of matrices. This sounds strange and a little bit funny. When I first saw this, I said, this cannot be true. But then people pointed me to this paper of Hastings, who said, if I have a gapped system, then, and I increase in this matrix product state ansatz, this bond dimension, the size of the matrix, then I will find an exponentially fast convergence to the exact ground state wave function. So it's not only that there was a proof that you find the solution, but also a proof that, that you converge to the solution in an exponentially fast way, which means in the end that, that you really you find this relevant space in the complete Hilbert space with exponentially fast, and you find it in a very controlled way. And this convinced me completely about this, this approach. And then with Ignacio Sirac and others, we tried this on gauge theories. And so we went back to, of course, the Schwinger model. What else? This is the only thing we can do, right? So we go from the Lagrangian formulation to the Hamiltonian. We introduce the canonical momenta. And then you can write down in the continuum the Hamiltonian formulation. So here you have, again, your Dirac operator. You have a mass term, and you have the electric field that corresponds to the gauge field. You have a Gauss law. The flux that you have is compensated by the coupling, by the charge here. And this is essentially another way of saying that this system is gauge invariant. Gauge invariance essentially means Gauss law. Then you can bring the system again on a lattice. It's the same way as we had before. The integral becomes a sum here. Then you have nearest neighbor interaction. You have this parallel transporter here, the Hermitian conjugate. You have a funny looking mass term because we use here a particular discretization. And you have the electric field term here. So then you have already a very nice formulation of the system, but you can even go further. You can do a Jordan-Wiechner transformation. And doing a Jordan-Wiechner transformation, you can go from a field basis really to a basis of these Pauli matrices. So the kinetic term looks like this here. These are just multiplication of Pauli matrices. The mass term looks like this here. And the electric field looks like this here. And now, if you use the Gauss law, which says that the difference of the flux between nearest neighbors on the lattice correspond to the charge, and the charge can be expressed in this term here, you can write this Hamiltonian completely in the form of Pauli matrices. And this is really perfect for matrix product states, where we have a lot of experience in this formulation. And just to say this, last year, there was even the very first quantum simulation of this model in the Pauli spin matrix. So this was the first demonstration that you can do a gauge theory on a quantum computer. This was the experiment in Innsbruck with Rainer Blatt, Peter Zoller. Christine Muschig is here at the IQC. So you have an expert about this very close by. And as I said, this was really the very first demonstration of this. So much earlier, together with Ignacio Sirac, Christoph Zichier, and Marie-Carmen Banuls, we did something like this low-lying baryon calculation in the Schwinger model. So we computed the vector and the scalar particle mass as a function of the quark mass. And we could get these masses to a very, very good precision. And this, I think this was, I have forgotten, 2013 or so, this was the very first demonstration that matrix product states can solve a gauge theory with such a precision and get really the particle spectrum. So this was very nice. This was really a deep learning curve for me, how to use this, how to apply this to gauge theories. But the real question is, of course, can I solve now a problem that is unsolvable with Markov chain Monte Carlo? Because such a spectrum I can also do with Markov chain. And I want to give an example that we did here together with Stefan Kühn since I was here in February, right? We're almost close to finish this. And we took a simpler model even. This is the CPN minus one model, the action of which is given is in this form here. So you have one over the coupling square. And then you have only a kinetic term with an n component vector. And with what makes this model here non-trivial is that the length of this vector is restricted to one. So this leads to some non-perturbative and non-trivial interaction. And this coupling here, 1 over g squared, we will call beta. The model is interested in itself already. It shows asymptotic freedom, which we have in QCD. We have a non-perturbatively generated mass scale, which is really also an effect in QCD, one of the most interesting ones, actually. And it has topological properties already. And interesting for us, it can be coupled to a chemical potential, and therefore it does not, it's not accessible to standard Markov chain Monte Carlo. Yeah, and this is what we did with Falk Buchmann, Stefan, and myself. And what I show here first is that this is the mass gap of the theory as a function of the coupling. So the continuum limit is in this direction here. This is some analytical prediction. And what we find is that if we go close enough to the continuum limit, we can actually make contact to this asymptotic form here. And I think this is actually the very first time that with tensor networks, we could make this contact here in this region. For me, new is in this game that we can also look at the entropy, and we can look at the scaling of the entropy towards the continuum limit again. And in this scaling law, which is given by this formula, enters the central charge. And what we find is, if we have large enough truncation of the models, that we get the central charge that is compatible with 2. If anybody in the audience can give us a sound theoretical argument why this should be 2, I would be very happy. If you give me a sound theoretical argument that it is 3, we will not discuss this. No, but what we find here is really that this seems to be compatible with 2, which seems to be 2 degrees of freedom towards the continuum limit. And adding the chemical potential here now just means that you add such a term here where mu is the chemical potential. And this you can do now in this Hamiltonian formulation with matrix product states. And what you find is, so this is the charge here. So when you change this chemical potential in this direction here, then you see that at certain values of this chemical potential, you have first order jumps. And so you can really explore the phase diagram in the model with a chemical potential, which would not have been possible with Markov chain Monte Carlo. I will not discuss how you do this in practice. If somebody is interested, I can explain this. So this is really the first time that I saw, it's the second time that I personally saw that we can do problems that cannot be done with Markov chain Monte Carlo using this matrix product state. We did the same in the Schwinger model some time ago, also with Stefan and Ignazio and others. And if you let me dream for a second, maybe in, I don't know, 10 years, then I would have this here, then we would have one. Okay. So this is all great. Again, we are superheroes. So how to proceed? How to proceed? We don't want to stay in 1+1 dimension. We eventually want to reach QCD. So we want to go to higher dimensions. So this is a graphical representation of these matrix product states. In higher dimensions, you have these kind of contractions. These are called projected entangled pair states. And here we really reach a problem. And the problem is, I told you, here I have d by d bond dimension times bond dimension matrices. And I have to increase this bond dimension to reach the desired solution. The cost for matrix product states is essentially d to the 3, so the third power of the size of the matrix. If I go to higher dimensions, then the computation cost scales as d to the 10. So even if you would have a matrix of size 10 by 10, which is clearly too small, this very fast becomes impossible. So either we need new ideas for tensor networks. There are some ideas, but they are not tested, and we do not know how this works. Or the clear way out would be quantum simulations. And we have already seen that you can simulate gauge theories on the quantum computer. So we have to develop methods to simulate more complicated gauge theories in higher dimensions and bring them on the quantum computer. I just want to give you a glimpse of my first experience of such a calculation. This was done together with Tobias Hartung. This is the quantum computing of a zeta regularized vacuum expectation value. So what we did, Feynman wrote down many years ago this famous trace formula to compute an expectation value of a physical observable through this e to the iht divided by this trace here, and putting the operator. Now, this is a nice formula, which doesn't exist, because you have to regulate it. So what we do, in lattice QCD, we go to Euclidean time. Then this has a mathematical meaning. But as it stands, it doesn't have any mathematical meaning. What Tobias showed in his thesis is that he can do a regularization through this zeta regularization and give a meaning to this. And what we did in this paper here, we could give a proof that when we do this, and we do a calculation in this zeta regularization, we get actually the real physical vacuum expectation value. And this has a huge advantage, not only that we can make sense out of this formula for the first time, but this is then defined in the continuum and in the Minkowski space. So if we, instead of using a Euclidean lattice, use this regularization, I can do directly non-perturbative simulations in the continuum in Minkowski space, which again would solve all the problems that I had before. Is this possible in practice? And we decided, yes, this is possible. And this is possible by doing a quantum computer simulation of this vacuum expectation value. So we went to Rigetti. We got access to the 8-qubit Agave chip, which is shown here. So these are the qubits. These are the connectivity. And what we saw is if we use the simulator at Rigetti and we switch off the noise, then we would have ideally an exponentially fast convergence to the expectation value that I want, which is really fantastic. So this would really solve all our problems. Now, a quantum computer has noise. And here is our experience in reality, so coming down to Earth. If you use one qubit, which has a fidelity of 9.98 and a read-off fidelity of 0.94, then we get a ground state, yes, with 5% error. So this is already nice. But if I go to more qubits, we were not able to find any significant result. So this is the reality at the moment for us, for this example, with quantum computing. But nevertheless, we could demonstrate that you can make practical use of this regularization and compute physical observables. And we are trying to do a more complicated system.
So could you explain this again? So you start with one qubit, and this works? Or no?
This is with one qubit. This is a particular discretization scheme in the continuum that we have used. And with one qubit, we could get a 5% accuracy for the ground state.
And as soon as you add more qubits, the thing explodes?
For two qubits, it went to 70% accuracy. Three qubits, we didn't find any convergence.
And that is because of the fidelity? If you could improve this by a factor of 10 or 100 or so, that would work?
This would work. This you can see here. If you would have no noise at all, you would see this exponential convergence. Okay. So this is what we are hoping. So all the companies are now promising a new set of chips. And we will see. I want to repeat this now on the new Rigetti set and see whether they could make improvements such that this could work. Let him again.
Why should you use zeta regularization specifically? Was that just convenient?
This is actually a question. Could we have done this also with continuum MPS?
Sure.
Question mark?
I mean, I was thinking more like an alternative regularization. Like there, you know, you could have gotten the divergence in some other way, than zeta regularization, right?
Like yeah, but. So my story didn't come through. Okay, so this is something that is completely ill-defined.
Yeah.
Okay. So Tobias showed that this can be defined by using this regularization.
Absolutely.
What we showed together, this is not only theoretically, this is practical, because I can get this expectation.
I'm not sure it's the right answer, but it's not the only way you could have gotten it, presumably, right? Like there are other regularization schemes you could have used. Like you go.
You should tell me privately, okay? Yeah, but this is very general. So this includes, for example, also our lattice regularization. This is one discretization scheme that you can use there. Yeah. But this is very, very general. and can be directly applied in the continuum in Minkowski space, which I think is a really great thing. Okay, let me summarize. I'm good in time. So what I wanted to do today is that I wanted to show you that our lattice QCD calculations are very, very, very much advanced. We can really do marvelous things, and we have a lot of impact for experiments. At the same time, we have really outstanding challenges, which is the chemical potentials, the p-violation, and real-time processes. There is this new ansatz. New is not new. For me, it's new. Matrix product states and matrix product operators, more general tensor networks. And what I showed you in our test bench calculations for models that are important for high energy physics, the CPN-1 and the Schwinger model, we can compute the spectrum, we can do chemical potential, and we also have access to the entropy, and Stefan also did the work for real-time simulation. So we can really address these things here. And at the same time, if you compare, for example, the spectrum calculation with this matrix product state ansatz, you can go to much larger systems than with the action formulation. So this has also an advantage there. So it completely overcomes the sign problem. This is very nice. The challenge here is that that we need to go to higher dimensions, where I at the moment don't see that the tensor network approach will work. And I put my coins on quantum simulations there because they don't need this bond dimension. Still, I think these tensor networks will be very, very important to check the quantum simulations and really go into corners where you can apply them and then check that what you do with quantum simulations give the correct result. Okay, thanks for your attention.
So let's start with questions from the students.
In the zeta regularization that you said, why are you able to extend the analysis to real time? Or where does real time go into that? Because I just see a beta in the expectation values that you're putting there.
I'm not sure I understand the question. So this is formulated in the continuum in the Minkowski space.
Okay. Yeah, that's amazing.
So the only thing that you need to do is you have to find a way to make the only thing. You have to find a way to make sense out of this formula. So this is the first way to do this. I showed you in the first part of the talk. We go to Euclidean time. Then this is e to the minus h times t. And we put it on a lattice. And then everything is completely well defined. And you can use this formula to get your physical observable. But the question is, what do you do when you have this object here? And our proposal is to use this zeta regularization, make everything finite, and you get the same physical expectation value.
Other questions from students? Okay, questions from anyone else?
A student up there.
So have you thought, in the CPN model, have you thought about adding a Bezuminian Euler term?
Not yet. I think no. This is possible. So you can do you can really look at topological charges and topological susceptibility in a model. There is a very similar continuum limit scaling formula like this one here, and you can really look at.
You would have two parameters, right? One for each term in the action.
I have to think about that one. I thought it's only one, but okay. But this you can do, and I think tomorrow we have a Skype and we want to discuss whether we want to do it. But if you tell us it's very interesting, we will do it. Please.
Can you test a super selection rule? That is like the statement that if you have in state theta 1, outstate theta 2, and any gauge invariant operator as a matrix element, that the result is always proportional to delta function of theta 1 minus theta 2, right? That there are no off-diagonal transitions. I don't think the lattice can check that, but with this Hamiltonian formulation, probably.
This should be possible. I haven't thought about this, but I think this is possible.
That's the really key start for the whole, you know, theta term program. So it's even more important than topological susceptibility.
Okay, okay. I think that's a good suggestion. Have you thought about this, Giffrey? No, you didn't. Okay. That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
There's this long-standing open question whether a massless upquark can actually solve the strong CP problem. And as far as I know, lattice QCD computations are bringing this into trouble. But there are some lattice QCD people like Michael Kreutz who say that you can't really trust these results because some of the results become ambiguous if you have a zero Yukawa coupling for the upquark, and then, you know, it's still an open question, he's claiming, I think. But I don't know what the state of the art is. So.
No, I totally agree. This is an open question because at zero quark mass, the problem is ill-defined. So you always have to do some kind of extrapolation there. You can try simulations at negative quark mass and positive quark mass and see whether you can shed some light on this. I think if you would come with either quantum simulations or tensor networks so far that we can go to four dimensions, this question could be answered. But from the lattice, I would not expect. There could be exceptional configurations, and no, it's an ill-defined problem.
So your answer to that question is that the theta, this question of whether theta can be rotated away, even if the quark mass is very small. If it's zero, we agree.
With zero, we agree. Yes.
But if it's small, which it is, does the lattice have anything to say about this problem? I think that's.
The question was just if the solution is still open, because many people argue that it's ruled out by lattice QCD, that one has the solution of the massless.
Yeah, but Mike also does some modeling there, right? This is not a pure lattice QCD calculation what he does, but he has a certain model, a certain picture in mind that he puts in, and then he tries to prove this. So for me, this is an open problem.
So if the quark mass is a few MeV, it's still open as to whether or not the data dependencies.
Yeah. Ray.
How many qubits do you need to do something which is interesting for lattice? Interesting in the sense that competes with classical computers.
100. I think 100 would be fine. I think with 100 I can beat Stefan. I can. No, but no, come on. With 100, I can go to two dimensions. I can do a lattice by 10 by 10, and then I'm already competing with tensor networks. Right? So this would be a situation where I would say now we are close to showing the supremacy. If Ignacio does not come up with the ingenious idea to improve tensor networks, or Giffrey. But 100, yeah, I'm dreaming of 100. I have several ideas there.
Okay, well, before we thank Carlton last time, let me just remind you that question period continues downstairs in the bistro with some snacks.